Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest for this morning is Dr. Catherine Prim. She is the owner and chief veterinarian at Applewood Animal Hospital in Ottawa, Tennessee. Dr. Prim and I will be discussing about the amazing world of pets and owners, which she revealed in her 2013 award-winning memoir, Tennessee Tales, Pets and Their People. Good morning, Catherine. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning. Thank you. I'm doing well.
Fantastic. I hope you guys are not freezing yourself out there. I know in Dallas, we're about to get the winter blast again one more time for this week.
I hope we don't get that.
It is a pleasure to have you on the air with me. Tennessee Tales, Pets and the People is a wonderful and entertaining read. It's a great book for both pet owners and animal lovers who may not necessarily have pets. So congratulations for your work.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Well, I write in the book that I don't really remember a time when I didn't love animals. I was kind of born this way, so to speak, and I loved all animals. My mom says before I could speak, I would try to communicate with cows grazing alongside the road, and horses specifically were my passion. I can't really explain why that is. It's just always been that way, and I like to think that it was just a way for me to start on my passion and on my mission.
Very interesting. I presume you watched the Super Bowl this past weekend.
Well, a little bit of it.
One of the commercials that they have, I thought, which was wonderful, they reminded me about you and your book in watching one of the commercials, the Budweiser commercials about that little dog
and
the horses. Yeah.
Yeah. That was great. I love that they always have animals there. And there was another ad with animals too, an Audi commercial, and that just makes me feel really good because it draws people's eye and mind to what animals bring to us.
Right. But that Audi ad was a little weird, though.
It wasn't my favorite. It wasn't touching. It was a little weird.
Right.
It kind of made me laugh.
Interesting. So you said you discovered that you like animals when you were young. At what point in time that you felt that you were really connecting with the animals?
Well, I started saying I wanted to be a veterinarian when I was about five, according to my mom. So, and I always begged for a horse. I begged for puppies and kittens. I always wanted animals, but I lived in the city. I didn't live on a farm. So, I wanted to live on a farm. I wanted to have a horse in my garage in the suburbs, and my parents, they weren't going along with that. And I never understood why that didn't work. But now I understand why that didn't work.
No, your uncle played an important role in your life in terms of getting you a horse. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I would beg and talk about horses all the time, and the term horse crazy that you hear, that applied to me. For sure. And I told him, and he had a farm, and I thought I saw some opportunity there. And I told him, I was really young, maybe five, I told him that he didn't have to buy me a new horse. He could get a used horse. Because I'd heard my parents talking about, you know, you could buy a used car and it was cheaper and that kind of thing. So he was kind of enamored and charmed by my request. So he did get me a used horse to live at his house. So that was just amazing. The day when I got there and she was there, that was amazing.
Wonderful. Your life experiences that influenced you to become a veterinarian, were there other people that were involved with your life that sort of steer you along the way to become a veterinarian as well?
Well, my parents always believed in me, and they always said that I could be anything I wanted to be. And they never said, oh, you'll never do it, you'll never make it. They always were right there saying, yes, what do you need to do to make this happen? And that was pretty instrumental. Of course, I read all the James Herriot books. I read every book about horses, dogs, and cats in our local library. And so that was kind of an influence as well.
How about your brothers and sisters? Were they really into animals as well?
No, and it's funny. My sisters, I have two sisters, and one of them is a CPA, and the other one is an economist.
Mm-hmm.
So it really couldn't be more different.
That's interesting. How about your parents then? Were they into animals?
They both love animals, but they didn't ever long to be veterinarians like I did. Mm-hmm. My dad tells stories about riding ponies when he was a little boy, and but no, this is I'm an aberration.
Interesting. So how has being a veterinarian enriched your life?
Well, absolutely. It is the best job for me. And I think everybody, as much time as we all spend at our job, we should love it and feel passionate about it. And it should be something that we feel like we make a difference. So I get to see amazing things. And that's part of why I wanted to write this book. Things that you wouldn't believe happen with people and their pets and stories around that. And it really gives me a glimpse at love and responsibility and honesty and all of these great characteristics that animals kind of show us that maybe we as people don't always have.
That's true, very true. A lot of people say that the animals take on the owner's personality, and then, of course, in some cases, the owner takes on the pet's personality, which is true.
Gosh, I guess it just depends on the person. you know, you've sort of bond with certain animals in your life, and I think maybe it's those animals that mirror you or that are how you want to be. I see that a lot because animals are so patient and kind, and when they do things, it's not because they are greedy or selfish or jealous. It's because they're animals. You know, they follow the rules, and I think that is something that people emulate or should emulate.
What are some of the most challenging aspects of your work?
Well, I think the biggest thing that frustrates me and challenges me about my work is that people can be really irresponsible. Mm-hmm. And we get phone calls and we hear stories that I just think we need to be better, that people need to be better by animals sometimes.
When you talk about irresponsibility, what are some of those irresponsibilities?
You know, I had a guy tell me one time there was something wrong with his dog, and I don't even remember the details on it. But I said, "Well, you know, here is an estimate for the charges of what I would recommend for this dog." And he said, "Well, I don't want to spend that money. I'll just take him out and shoot him." And I was like, "Are you kidding me? I mean, really?"
Oh my God! Yeah.
So I mean, you know, and I hope he wasn't serious. He left. I hope he wasn't serious, but. Yeah, you just wouldn't believe. I try to highlight the good things in the book and the people that were responsible and loving. And I guess I could write another book about people that kind of let animals down, but I don't know if we want to focus on that.
How about some of the rewards?
Well, when people do the right thing, it makes me proud. You know, I think that it just makes us all feel really good when we see a relationship like that, where an owner maybe makes a choice that kind of hurts them but was right by the animal, you know, living up to your responsibilities to your friend.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine there are two types of owners, one who really embraces their pets, no matter what that is, to be a part of the family. And then you have the other one who embraces their pets as an attachment and
disposable.
As a thing. And that's when you get into the concept of, well, if so-and-so is this way, then I'll just get another one.
Yeah.
There's no emotional
attachment.
That kind of
makes me sad. Yeah.
So what is the inspiration behind Tennessee Tales? I know the years of you've been at work that certainly gave you the opportunity to think about perhaps I need to put it on paper into words. But what is the real inspiration behind Tennessee Tales?
Well, I think that some of the stuff in Tennessee Tales was really amazing. And I'm kind of a storyteller at heart. I like to tell stories, and all day, you know, my staff heard all of my stories, and so I was telling them, and somebody said, you should write those down. So I started doing a blog, and I would publish stories on the blog, and lots of people said, you know, you should compile these, you should write a book, and that was on my bucket list, I guess, so I did that. But I think the stories are designed to tell some of the amazing things that I've seen, and to help people really see that pets can be a blessing and they can help us grow and they can teach us how we can be better people.
You're too young to have a bucket list.
I don't know. You're never too young for a bucket list.
Reading your book, the main theme that came across to me is the relationships between pets and the owners, of course. And, of course, you mentioned that in your book, the fact that it is about unconditional love. So tell us a little bit about that, what your take in terms of what unconditional love means to you.
Well, I think that animals show us a steady, kind of unchanging joy. And I see occasionally on social media people post little quotes and things about animals. They always make me smile. Be the person that your dog thinks you are. You know, every day, every time you walk in the door, your dog's happy to see you. Your cat is calm and purrs and is steady and warm as a presence for you, no matter how your day was. You can count on that, and that is unchanging and something that you can depend on, and I think we all benefit from that.
That's true. Either that or they have a very short attention span.
Well, they grow out of that, hopefully.
That's right. They don't hold grudges.
Right.
I agree. I understand that. So why should people read this book?
Well, I think that it'll make you laugh and it'll make you cry. I think you said it made you, it was a little bit moving to you in some cases. But you won't believe some of the things. Some of the stories in there, people are like, no way, but they really happened. So you get a glimpse of some of the stuff that I see that's unbelievable or that's awe-inspiring or that made me proud or made me sad. You get to really see, and I laid it all out there. I didn't really hold back on my emotions. I tell people my editor was sending me back manuscript copies, and I told her, I said, I feel like I've opened up my underwear drawer for you to look in. And she said, oh, girl, you've opened up your lingerie drawer and you've spread out all the pieces for everybody to look at.
I see. With regards to pets, your practice, it seems like you have narrowed it down, of course, your love for horses, and then eventually you talk about you have narrowed it down to home animals and so forth. Are there any exotic animals that you have ever encountered in your practice?
In my practice, I no longer treat exotics, but I did when I first opened. And I actually, in vet school, I really got to treat some cool ones. I got to treat an ostrich and an emu and a llama. We had some really, really very exotic things that wouldn't come up very often for any veterinarian that I had the pleasure of learning about.
That's interesting. And I don't know whether this is a conflict of interest if I mentioned this, but what's interesting was years ago I had someone that worked with me. She does show horses, and one weekend she had to leave early, well, towards the weekend that is. She told me she had to bring a horse to a chiropractor, and I didn't even realize they have animal chiropractors.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And that is actually something that is coming to the forefront for our companion pets as well, chiropractics and physical therapy and acupuncture as alternative therapies. We have started to realize that not only can people benefit from PT, but dogs can after surgeries or from osteoarthritis. And I certainly recommend that very regularly to patients.
That's interesting. Very, very interesting. Are pets really our best friends?
They certainly can be, because they have a lot to teach you, and they'll be there even, you know, you're never going to really make your dog or cat angry, and you're never going to say anything that makes them not want to be your friend.
I don't know about angry, though, because I know when I was growing up, we have a pet dog. I named him Pele after the football player from Brazil. Well, what happens to Pele is that we spoiled him. He has his own bed. He goes to bed at 8 o'clock at night. If there's any noise outside the house, he's looking at you to check it out. He's not going to check it out. And I was like, we have the dog right here, right? The protector of the family. And then I remember, but he's such a beautiful dog. He's a crossbreed, and I can't remember the exact breed that we have, but he turned out to be a very studly dog, I mean, in terms of big, nice, handsome-looking, and he barks loud. He would sort of like show his teeth and all that. But when he was a puppy, I would stick my hand in his mouth so that whenever he wants to bite, he can't really bite down, if that makes sense, you know, like I stick my hand all the way. So he never learned really know how to bite. I mean, you know how to hold people. No one knew that. Everybody thought that it's a killer dog.
He looked tough, right?
Right, yeah, yeah. I remember that he would get mad that when we leave the house to go shopping or whatever and leave him on his own, he'll be crying. And then when my mom comes home and when I would come home, he would just run off and not be with us. Like, okay, you don't want to be with me and I don't want to be with you either. Things like that. And then, of course, when he wants to play, he would go into my room and grab one of my undershirts and toss it in front of me while I'm watching TV or something and start wagging his tail and, you know, things like that that sort of bring back wonderful memories in reading your book.
Well, thank you. I'm glad. I think that they are their own individual personality. I mean, I hear that several times a day. People tell me, you wouldn't believe what she does, you know, and it's so interesting, and it deserves to be written, so I wrote it.
Well, wonderful. How are we seen through the eyes of our pet?
Well, people have a joke about dogs having masters and cats having staff. Mm-hmm. And that makes me laugh because I do kind of serve my cats. But I think that they see us as part of their family, as part of their pack, as part of their, you know, cats don't live in a pack, but maybe a sibling or a child or a parent. I really think that they see us as family, and animals understand a family concept, which fits in well with the way human beings are, because we understand family.
And I believe that dogs and cats can get along very well, because when I was growing up, we have cats too. Both our dogs and our cats can eat together without fighting each other.
Absolutely, yes. And you hear stories about unlikely friendships, dogs and deer. And I saw a really funny photograph, I think it was on Facebook or something, where it was this humongous white rat and this fairly small little black kitten kind of curled up sleeping together. And the caption said, "You had one job, cat." But, you know, unlikely friendships, and maybe that's why they love us. Maybe it's an unlikely friendship for them that they're allowing themselves to be friends with the likes of us.
Very true. What can our pets teach us?
Well, I think that if you can find joy in a sunbeam, like my cat does, if you can just race to the door every time you hear it open with unbridled love and joy, like my dog does, then you are made better by that. You know, it's they don't care about what kind of car they drive. They don't care whether or not everybody thinks they look good. I think there's tons of stuff we can learn from them.
True. So give us a quick synopsis of your book.
Well, it's just little vignettes of things that I have seen and done, ways that animals have taught me lessons and made me better, ways that animals have taught my clients lessons, and I just got to kind of watch it. Maybe how dogs and cats can be sort of an audience to the story of our lives, and we can be an audience to the story of theirs.
Interesting. When can our love for our pets be considered too much?
You know, I don't think that there is ever too much love. And my mom used to tell me, love multiplies, but it doesn't divide.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is true. I think when you have situations like animal hoarders or situations where maybe you and I might think that something was excessive, potentially that doesn't come from love. Maybe it comes from something else. I've had cases where I personally felt in my heart that the owner took a terminal disease too far and was unable to make the call where I really thought the animal deserved the dignity of you know, a humane euthanasia or something like that.
Yeah.
I really feel like that comes from maybe not love. I'm not sure that those clients are unable to let go because of how much they love the pet. Maybe they are unable to let go because of other aspects of their personality or their life or other experiences that they've had. And so you might instantly jump to it and say they loved her too much, but I'm not sure that's what it is.
I see. Have you been called a pet whisperer?
I've been called lots of things. We won't go into those here. But I do love them, and I think I hear pretty consistently in reviews of my animal hospital or even reviews of my book that people can tell I love them, and I don't really try to hide it.
One of the things that I noticed over the years is that there are people that are just natural. I know that for me and my mom especially, we can be around animals, and the animals, I guess, pick up the vibes, our vibes, and they gravitate towards us because they can kind of feel the certain energy of love or whatever you want to call it, the calmness and the connection. What is your take on that?
I think that's true. And if you think about how animals work, they have nonverbal communications, obviously, since they can't speak. And they are so tuned in to the way people move, the way people hold themselves, the expressions on their faces, that maybe you and your mom just seem very at ease and seem and feel very happy, and those animals know that, and it makes them instantly comfortable.
Because, I mean, like my mom, the animals would just kind of gravitate towards her. This is a real funny story. Like, in the whole house, the only person that my dog respect actually or be afraid is my dad, even though he's really nice, but he just kind of give out that energy like, you know, I'm the head of household, don't mess with me.
Right.
I remember that my dad loved to sit in his lazy chair in the living room, and my dog would kind of like do a beeline, you know, all around him. Walking right past by him. I mean, it was so funny. And then my dad and my mom would like instigate like a little quarrel or a fight just to see the reaction. And the dog would be on my mom's side. I mean, the dog is choosing side on who to defend kind of thing, you know.
Right. So. He knows who needs him.
How do we determine which pet is best for us?
You mean which, whether it's a dog or a cat, or do you mean a specific?
Yeah, dog or a cat especially. Of course, I mean, they are animals that some people just enjoy having gerbils and stuff like. But basically, like for dogs and cats, which one is the best one for us?
You know, it's important to do your research and think about what you want out of the relationship with this pet. Because if you want someone to go hiking with you, a cat's not going to work. That doesn't mean you can't have a cat, but the cat's probably not going to hike with you. And if you want something that will hang out with you while you write a book, it's a cat. And, I mean, I know you read the story of Merlin and how he went through vet school with me and laid on my textbooks.
Yeah.
You know, he was perfect for that job, and he kept me focused and made me not feel alone. So I think you just have to think about, what do I want out of this relationship?
That's interesting, though, because I would think dogs would be much more apt to being loving from that standpoint of view, like wanting to hang out with you, versus cats, is my experience. Cats tend to be wanting to be on their own, don't they?
Sometimes. It depends on the cat. Merlin did not want to be on his own. And if I locked him out of the room where I was, he would lean his little mouth under the door, in that tiny little space under the door, and he would meow. And everybody said he was saying mama, because it would go, you know, he would meow. And so he did not like to be separated from me. So it depends on the cat. And I would encourage people, when you're looking and you're picking a pet, spend some time with that pet, because they have their own personality, and you want to see if it meshes with yours.
Yeah, I would think so, because if you are the person that really wanted to have the pet all the time and stay connected, watching TV and those kind of things, those should come into play, shouldn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that's what you want from the relationship, and you can make good choices to kind of assure that that's what you'll get.
Yeah, yeah. That reminds me, when I was growing up, again, I was talking about Pele. He would get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and have his milk, and then at that time he'll sit by my door, and my mom has to open my bedroom door and let him in, and then he'll scratch my feet and I have to move it, and he'll come into bed with me and sleep for however long I would sleep, you know, and he gets up in time just for lunch. So
yeah, they're
he
so
has
cool.
a good life. Yeah, they have a good life. At least my dog, in this case, he realized that he's a member of the family. My mom had bought him a nice placemat. He would eat food. Of course, the actual food would be like in a bowl, but like as far as my mom would feed him bananas, and all my mom had to do was to peel it a little bit, and he knows how to hold it and just peel the banana, eat banana. He knows how to eat ice cream. And believe it or not, anything that fell out from that placemat, he will not eat it. Yeah, so he's
Aren't
not,
they
you
fun?
Know,
they're so individual, and they really do have personalities. And I think if someone doesn't believe that they have personalities because maybe they're not an animal person, I think they should read my book, because I can prove it.
I think the most important thing, and I believe you will agree with me on this, is that when you get the puppy, if you treat that puppy with love, kindness, and everything else, they pick up those traits, those personality. And I believe if you're vicious with the puppy, no matter... It might be a golden retriever, for that matter. You don't have to be a pit bull. A golden retriever can grow up to be a pit bull.
Yeah. Yeah, you kind of reap what you sow, but that's good, because most people aren't going to be abusive, and they're going to get love back from those puppies.
Right, right. So what's the favorite story for you in the book?
Oh, I would say Merlin, just because I lived it. But I love all the stories, because I spent so much time with them. I lived them, first of all. Then I wrote them down, and then I revised them, and then I read them again. They're all really, really personal to me. And actually, the other day I was counting the number of chapters, how many of those animals are still here. You know, because animals don't live as long as we do. And there are actually 4 of the chapters still are my patients, still are alive, and still are making people's lives better. So I think that's really pretty cool. I mean, as time goes on, it won't be, but right now there are 4 of them.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the enjoyable stories. Any particular one that you enjoyed in terms of the fun thing of being a vet?
The fun of being a vet. Well, I enjoy my dog. Chapter 14 is about my dog, and I enjoy her every day, because she's such a character. I mean, she's just her own. She's her own woman. And even the sad stories are kind of happy. The story of Jackpot, where I went through 16 years with him and his family, and his cancer that he never succumbed to. That's a great story. It was fun to live, and his family still comes here with a different dog.
Right.
And you know, I think I made a difference for him, and I think I made a difference for his family as well.
How much connection do you feel like you have with the owners?
Well, a lot. I try to be a good resource for them when they make decisions, mm-hmm. and I really try to build a lot of trust. I think that is so extremely important that they trust my recommendations and they know that I'm looking out for them and putting the animal first, because the animal has no voice except for me. And mm-hmm. and that is actually a source of joy for me as well, feeling like I have earned someone's trust. Even if maybe the first time they came in they didn't trust me and now I know that they do, that is very rewarding to me.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you talk about the Chihuahua as being the dog that bites the most.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, they did an insurance study. I'm not even sure who originally did it. I would say probably the American Veterinary Medical Association, but I'm not sure, did a study of which dogs are most likely to bite a veterinarian. And, you know, everybody would say, oh, Rottweilers, German Shepherds, you know, and it was a Chihuahua.
Yeah.
And I thought that was noteworthy enough that I put it in the book.
Well, they have a different kind of personality, I would think, versus the big dogs, because the big dogs, perhaps maybe they're big, they kind of realize that, you know, I could hang with this.
Yeah, maybe the little ones are afraid.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. Is it a dog or a cat better suited for small children?
Again, it just depends on what you want out of the relationship. I have clients that cats sleep with their babies and watch after the babies. And I've heard all kinds of stories where cats were amazing companions. And, of course, I love dogs and cats, so I think that they both are a really good thing to have around a child, because they just teach us things, and it's warmth, and it's family, and it's a friend that you can provide. So I like them both.
Okay. Let us talk about Desperate House Dog chapter. I thought it was really funny.
Yeah, that was funny, and that story, I guess for the listeners, that story is about a very unique experience that I had, where it proved to be that a couple was kind of meeting. They were kind of rendezvousing here at the animal hospital in the guise of getting veterinary care for their dogs. And a lot of people have commented and reviewed and said, oh, my gosh, could they not find a cheaper way to get to meet? I don't know the details, but gradually it dawned on me that they really were not always here for just the dog. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of tongue-in-cheek, and we joked about it. But, I thought it was worth writing about.
Interesting. I guess I may have to borrow someone else's dog and try to do something like that.
I think there's a movie about that, or some kind of something about having a dog as a conversation starter.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Are there dogs that are more intelligent than other dogs, and are there dogs that are more for, say, homebound versus outdoors?
Yes. Well, they have definite personality traits in an individual dog. Will have, I have a patient that is a companion for a man in a wheelchair, and she basically stays with him all the time, because he doesn't really get out much, and we talk about her weight because she doesn't get enough exercise. And when she comes here to board, when they go out of town, it was recent, in fact, she stays at the front desk with my staff and kind of sits there with them as they roll around in their office chairs and things, or she gets really anxious because she spends her day in someone's lap. So she was stressed in the kennel and listening to the other dogs. She thinks she's a person. So she spent a lot of her boarding time at my front desk visiting and greeting the clients that come in and out. So she is well suited for her job. She's little, but she's a little fat.
Now, we all have heard about seeing eye dogs that helps patients to see. A few years back, I met someone, we became friends. He lives in North Carolina, he has a dog that helps him in terms of hearing things.
Right.
Is that pretty much something that it's up and coming?
I think so. In fact, it can go a step further than that. I like to write and talk about ways that animals make our lives better in social media and on my blog and things. And so I pay attention to any kind of headline I see. And they have dogs that they're working with that can sense a diabetic patient's blood sugar levels.
Yeah.
And alert a caregiver without the patient having to be stuck, you know, for a blood sample.
Yeah.
They have dogs
yeah.
that can sense seizure disorders in children. They can, for whatever reason, the biological or biochemical changes associated with a seizure is something that you can train a dog to be tuned into. And, I mean, think about if that was your child that was seizuring.
Yeah.
If that dog could warn you and you could make whatever changes needed to be made. I mean, that's pretty huge.
Yeah, yeah. In Jim's situation, the dog actually has saved his life because he can't hear very well, and at night when he goes to bed, he takes his hearing aid off. So he can't hear a thing. The dog heard someone knocking on the hotel door where he was staying because there was a fire.
Oh.
Until that time, I've never heard of a dog being used in that capacity before.
Yeah, it's amazing. I hear stories all the time of animals, cats too, that get people out of burning houses and things all the time. It's such a gift, and they are such a blessing in so many different ways.
What was the most difficult patient you ever encountered?
The most difficult patient. Well, you know, I write in the Desperate House Dog story about how that dog could bite us 17 times. From the exam room to the lab area,
yeah.
and we
yeah.
had to wear the gloves and things. That was pretty difficult because I felt like I didn't have a connection with her. She was so afraid of me, and we just didn't have a connection where she knew I was trying to help her.
Mm-hmm.
But if you read the story, the one I'm scared yarn it about the cat with the anxiety issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, eventually I have managed to pet him on the head. He's still a patient. I have managed to pet him on the head, and it has taken me years to get to that point. And he's bad. I mean, he can be dangerous, but we're getting by.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Did you ever encounter a difficult parent in this case? Owner?
You know that I can't say no. You know, one time I went into an exam room, I'll never forget this, and the man said, "Why would I do all of this?" I gave him a treatment plan for whatever
yeah.
was wrong with his dog, and he said, "Why would I do this? This is just a dog."
Yeah.
And, you know, I looked at him and I said, "You know, I think that the one person in the world that shouldn't think he's just a dog
mm-hmm.
is your veterinarian."
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at me, and he sat there. I didn't know what he was going to say because that was pretty forward of me to just say. And he said,
yeah.
"You know what? You're right.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the people in the world that shouldn't think he's just a dog, it should be you." And he let me do those treatments that I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So you're right. Two groups of people, you know, people that think they're disposable and people
right.
that think they're family, but there's a group in between, and that's where
yeah.
I come in, you know,
yeah.
of – trying to speak wisdom and, you know, explain things to pull them into one camp away from the other camp.
Interesting. Have you ever treated, like, boa constrictors and stuff like that?
Yes, I have, but not here at Applebrook.
Uh-huh.
I did before, and you really can't bond as much. I know there are people that have snakes and exotic pets that
yeah,
feel that they
yeah.
have a bond. But as a veterinarian, just seeing them for the time period where they're treating,
yeah.
we're treating the illness, it's harder to bond. And certainly the most fun part of my job is seeing a puppy the first visit when they come from a rescue and getting to watch them
yeah.
grow at every
mm-hmm.
visit, and then they're happy to see you. I go into the exam room and I say, "Hey," and the little puppy's just wagging and so happy. And
yeah,
that
yeah.
is, that's the joy for me. And a snake really doesn't do that.
Now that you only treat domesticated animals, I guess, would you turn someone away? I mean, if they were to bring a boa constrictor or something like that? I'm just wondering.
Well, you know, I actually had a lady, I think yesterday, that asked me, she brings her dogs and cats here, and she said, but we have some exotic pets, and we have sugar gliders, I think is what she had. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, someone else would probably be more qualified because I haven't worked on those in years. But if you can't find anyone, you bring them to me and you and I will work together and I'll pull out all my old stuff. And, you know, so I guess I couldn't really say I would turn them away, but they might get better care from a veterinarian who routinely sees them every day.
I see. Interesting. What are some of the most common mistakes pet owners share?
I think the biggest thing I see pretty much always is not doing preventive care, not recognizing that I need to see that pet even when she's not sick. Or when she is sick, they go onto the internet and they read a list of things it could be, and they kind of try to treat it at home and cut us out of the loop, and then by the time we do see it, it's too late. That is... I would say that's the most common mistake, is not letting me see them for wellness care and not doing their preventive stuff.
They have pet insurance now, don't they?
Yes. In the story Out of the Closet, you know, that was a parvo case, and that's a vaccinatable disease. That story wouldn't have happened if those dogs had been vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, I have a website for the book, my author site, and it is drprim, drprimm.com. And I've got my little schedule on there and a link to the Amazon and Barnes & Noble where you can buy the book. And I try to keep all the happenings and interesting things listed there. We're actually doing a Goodreads giveaway to get an autographed copy of the book right now, and that's on there. So if anyone is interested in having a giveaway that is autographed, that would be a good place to start.
Wonderful. What are the different types of veterinarians in terms of medicine and treating different animals? Are there different classifications of veterinarians, so to speak?
Well, kind of, but when you go through vet school, you learn it all. And that's good for you. It really is. I mean, I worked on cattle. I worked on everything from A to Z, you will. But when you get out into practice, you get to define what you do a little more. And there are still mixed animal practices that treat dogs and cats and horses and cows and all of it. But most of us have kind of subdivided into companion pets versus food animals. And lots of people do exclusively horses, because that's kind of a different thing. So you have to decide for yourself, I guess, which direction you want to take it.
What are some of the enjoyable moments that you've encountered?
Enjoyable moments. Every day. like I said yesterday when I went into an exam room to see a puppy, and it was the second puppy visit, so I'd already gotten to play with the puppy before, and she knows me. But I came in, and I said, well, hello, how is everyone? And she just about came out of her skin. She was so excited to see me, and wagging her tail all over, and it just makes you happy, makes you smile. You can't be sad when someone is that happy to see you.
How has Rising Tennessee Tales impacted you personally?
Oh, it's so much fun. I loved living them, and I loved writing them, but I also love to talk about them. And I get to meet people and answer questions. And I went and talked to a middle school class, a grade at a girls' school, and they all raised their hands and said they wanted to be veterinarians and asked me questions about how I did it and was it worth it and all of that kind of stuff. And I really feel like this is this is a way that I can help people and make an impact.
Is there a shortage of veterinarians nationwide?
That depends on who you ask. There is definitely a shortage of food animal veterinarians. And when people think about veterinarians, you don't think about – veterinarians are the ones that are responsible for our food safety. There are veterinarians employed by the USDA that check our food source type meats and things, and there are diseases that can be transmitted from pets and food animals to people and so on. And those jobs fall to veterinarians. And so we don't want to not have veterinarians. So, but I think there are lots of veterinarians graduating, but there are lots of jobs for veterinarians as well.
Interesting. Your book gave a wonderful snapshot about a veterinarian hospital. Is that something difficult to do where other vets may not want to necessarily put the information out there in some ways?
Maybe. I think that knowledge is power. And and if you know what you're dealing with, it equips you to prevent things and to head off things and plan for things. But I don't feel threatened by people knowing what I do. But maybe some people do. You know, there used to be a culture of all doctors kind of, you just didn't want to tell that. You know, it wanted to have that mystery knowledge. And I think that time has passed. I think that the more my clients know about how to do this, the more they value that I know and the more they listen to me.
Interesting. You mentioned quite a bit about your alma mater, Mississippi State University Veterinary School. And you mentioned something about the ability to teach you something that you thought other schools do not teach and has helped you along the way. What are some of the things that you had an advantage of, say, from someone else?
Well, I think that it taught me that nobody knows everything, but you have to know where to look and be a bulldog. That was the pun intended because their mascot's a bulldog. But be a bulldog and don't stop until you find someone who knows that answer. And I use that every day. I'm an expert on some things, but I'm not an expert on everything. And I pride myself on having the resources to ask and to find it. And my clients know I won't stop until I find the answer to their question to their satisfaction. So that was important. When I graduated, I was ready to go. I was ready to practice. And I'm not sure every school, I'm not sure new graduates from every school, I don't really know, but I'm not sure they are ready to go like we were. We were very well prepared.
Interesting. What three advice would you give to new veterinarians graduating this year?
I would say to make sure that it is your passion.
Mm-hmm.
Because you spend so much time at work and you give so much of yourself to this, that you have to feel like you're making a difference. And it's got to be what drives you, or you may not find fulfillment in this job. I think that it is important to know yourself so you can decide which avenue of veterinary medicine might be the best one for you. And, of course, you change and you grow as you go along. I certainly have since I started out thinking I wanted to work on only horses, and now I don't work on horses at all. So I think knowing yourself, making sure that you follow your passion, and I don't know, they say in all the veterinary trade things that new graduates are graduating with an enormous amount of student debt, and people have talked about, do you really want to be a veterinarian? Do you want to graduate owing all of this money, knowing that you'll be paying on that for so long? And if it's your passion and it's a part of you, that's less important.
And as far as practice is concerned, should they be trying to hook up with some bigger organizations, or should they just try it on their own? Unlike the medical field, I guess, where you can have a group of doctors that pretty much form a clinic in some ways, do veterinarians do that?
Yes, and especially in large metropolitan areas, there will be animal hospitals with several doctors. I would say an animal hospital like mine, Applebrook Animal Hospital, is probably going to be a dinosaur before too long. I think we're probably headed towards the big practices because I can't, you know, I don't see emergencies. I have to refer because I can't work 24 hours a day. And some of these big practices can, with six or eight doctors, they can provide that. And I think that that may be what's coming in the future. I hope not, because we'll lose something. Because my animal hospital and my clients knowing that they're going to see me and my familiarity with the pets and the people help me be a better doctor for them. And I think that we would really be losing something if it went away, but you know how progress is.
Yeah. Well, I guess, again, too, depending on which part of the country you want to set up your practice. If you are in a small to mid-sized town, then you may have the opportunity to build a wonderful clientele.
Right.
Coming back to your work as a veterinarian, and one of the things that you've done that you have linked up with charities. So tell us a little bit the charities that you're involved with.
Well, I have decided that all of the proceeds for the first year from the sale of the book, after we pay for the cost of the publication and the promotion, will go to a couple of local rescue groups because it's a struggle. They have such a struggle. And these animals, they were the disposable ones, you know, that people just didn't, they thought it was just a dog and they didn't want to fool with it, so they dumped it out. Or they decided they wouldn't be responsible and they didn't spay its mother or, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, and I do work with actually several rescue groups here, making sure that their rescue pets are checked out and healthy and spayed or neutered before they go to their home, that kind of thing. So I think that's a part of my mission, too, is just making sure that everyone has an opportunity to have this kind of relationship and every pet has an opportunity to have a home.
Interesting. When you talk about rescue dogs and rescue cats and so forth, are there special consideration that pet owners need to think about before they adopt those animals?
Well, you know, they say adopt, don't shop, because there are so many homeless pets that are being destroyed across the country, and so they don't recommend going to pet stores and spending money, you know, that kind of thing. So, and I believe that, you know, perfectly healthy animals that can add so much to your life really are just waiting there for someone to find them. And I just feel like I have seen them add so much to so many lives that I don't want anybody to miss out on that.
Mm-hmm. How about the psychological side of the pets in terms of they've been in a situation where they've been exposed to such horrific conditioning? Can they ever flip over and change?
Well, you know, they don't hold grudges. And they can be trained to trust. I mean, that kind of thing, trust and love and joy really come easily to them.
Yeah.
So if you have patience, I think you can work through that. And if you feel that bond, you can get through it.
Mm-hmm. I think the love and the bond that you talk about has to be generated by the owner.
Right.
Interesting.
Because they're there. They're just waiting for you to love them.
Is book two on the horizon?
It is. It is in a rough manuscript form, and I've got the content. I need to do some polishing on it. I'm not sure of a timeline, really, because I do still practice full-time. I see patients, and we're busy. But, yes, it is. I just don't know for sure when. I tell people, go to my website, because I'll post it, or I'll email everybody when it's about to come out, but it's not quite there yet.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. How has the people in the book that were mentioned in the book respond to the book?
They love it. I gave everybody that was in the book a signed copy and said, you know, check out chapter 11 or whatever. well, actually not chapter 11 because that's Desperate House Dogs. But and they have, it's just been so amazing, the feedback. I hear every day. Every day, sometimes more than once a day, oh, my daughter read your book. Oh, you know, can you sign this book for me? It has really made a difference for me. And I had a lady tell me at a book signing, it was huge to me. She said, I had a stroke and I was in the hospital and somebody brought me your book when I went to the rehab center. And she said, and that was a dark day when I transferred over to the rehab center and I was afraid. And she said, but your book got me through it. And I kind of got chills, you know. It just touched me that she said that.
That's wonderful. But I'm sure, on the other hand, though, everybody is interested in that. How come I wasn't there when the Desperate House Dogs were happening? I want to know who these people are.
I can't tell you that.
Was I there, Doc? You know, I mean,
Nobody has asked me that. Nobody has said, so who were they? You know, nobody has, but it's been a while, so, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. I wonder if they've read it. Are they out there thinking, was that us? did she know? I don't know.
Interesting. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
Absolutely. And I think the whole book leads us down the path of open your eyes, because your blessings might be right there wagging their tail at your feet. It's just open your eyes. They're there, and blessings are here for us all, and it can be as simple as a cat rubbing their face on you and purring. It can be, it can be as complicated as a dog that can tell when you're going to have a seizure.
Mm-hmm.
It's there, and the world offers us these blessings, and you just have to see them, and you have to recognize them and reach out and grab them.
Basically, just pay attention and just enjoy the present moment and be aware of your surroundings. And sometimes it don't need to be people. It could be animals that can love you unconditionally.
Exactly. Angels can come in all forms.
That's right. And actually draws the best out of you.
Yes. Absolutely.
Wonderful. Catherine, thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning for our Valentine's Day special. My guest will be Amy Newmark, the publisher and editor-in-chief for Chicken Soup for the Soul. Amy and I will be discussing their latest edition, The Dating Game, 101 Stories About Looking for Love and Finding Fairy Tale Romance. She will reveal stories from bad dates to good ones, blind dates to old friends turning into more, and online dating to chance meetings. According to Amy, this collection will make you laugh, give you hope, and remind you why you love the one you're with. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening, and have a blessed week. Dr. Prem, it has been a pleasure. Thank you again, and have a blessed day.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.